listening to the Everything You Want to Know About Therapy But We're Too Afraid to Ask podcast with your host, Jessica Strang, and your co-host, Jennifer Trevelli. If you've ever wanted to start therapy but didn't know where to begin, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, we will offer, what you call Therapy 101 by interviewing experts in the field and asking them anything and everything you want to know about therapy before you make that first appointment.
Grace Dickman is a licensed clinical social worker running her own private practice, Real Therapy, in Brooklyn, New York. Grace has over 10 years of nonprofit experience working in schools in the south and west sides of Chicago and transitioned to working in private practice in 2017. She holds an MSW from the University of Chicago and is trained in acceptance and commitment therapy, exposure and response prevention, and EMDR. Grace has been awarded several international fellowships and professional exchanges in the UK, Morocco, Egypt, and India to study the intersections of gender, trauma, and community services. She is currently licensed in 3 states and actively working on expanding her private practice. Grace is passionate about working with young adults, teens, women, and people exploring their gender and sexual identities. She specializes in trauma and the many ways the brain and body adapt to it. Many of her clients struggle with OCD, anxiety, difficulties in relationships, low self-esteem, life transitions, and are members of the LGBTQ+ community. She uses a mix of several evidence-based therapy modalities to help clients deepen their relationship to self, experiment with new ways of living, and move confidently towards the things that matter most. Grace Dickman, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Hello. Thank you so much for being here. And we always start off our podcast by asking all our experts, when did you begin studying psychology? Like, when was the beginning of, in it, whenever that is, you know, high school, before that, last week, doubtful, but, when did you
begin? Hopefully
not. Yeah. When did you begin?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I officially started studying social work in college, but my interest in helping others started from a really young age. So I grew up in an all-woman household with a single mother, and many of my family members worked in public service, so whether education, government, law, and so I knew from a young age I really wanted to help others in the community. I just wasn't really sure how. And I personally had some rough times in childhood and adolescence, and my reaction to those things was to turn inward and do a lot of questioning about why was this all happening and why couldn't it be different and what could I do to fix it, and also like how was I going to show up to school the next day and take my math exam and do those very functional things, right? So that struggle and some of the curiosity I developed around it led me to thinking I wanted to study psychology in college, which was probably the most accessible option that seemed to fit the bill at the time. But it wasn't until I took a human services class in undergrad when I really realized I wanted to support individuals and their communities. So, I became more interested in a systems perspective where I could really begin to see the links and intersections between people and all these bigger systems like family, education, healthcare, politics. So I moved through a degree in human services and then eventually worked for a couple years after graduation in nonprofits, and then realized that what I really wanted to do to continue my education and my work was to focus on social work instead, which is very similar to human services, but just adds a layer of education and training and licensure and a lot of sort of like clinical focus also wrapped up in it. So then I got my master's from the University of Chicago and continued working in nonprofits, and then eventually transitioned into working into private practice, which is where I am now.
Can you tell us, Grace, a little bit about kind of what your current position and your current work is and what it looks like?
Yeah, definitely. So I am currently the owner, creator, and biggest fan of my private practice, Real Therapy.
Yes. Okay.
Which I have loved building over the past few years. So I'm just a solo practitioner doing clinical services, mostly one-on-one with clients right now, although I do work with some partners and I do also run some groups.
That's amazing. And I know one of the reasons that we, you know, reached out to you and we're so excited to have you on the podcast to talk about it with your expertise was working with the LGBTQI plus community. Can you tell me what made you feel interested in working with this particular community?
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's, you know, as with most things in this work, there's a lot of personal and professional roots to my interest there. So, you know, growing up, I always saw things through a very gendered lens and became quickly attuned to all of the expectations and assumptions and rules in our culture around gender or perceived gender. And I took that into my nonprofit work where I was running gender-based programs that were mostly advertised for young women, but left out a lot of students who fall between the binary, the gender binary, and even in some ways really perpetuated gender stereotypes. So luckily I was in grad school at the time, so I really dove deep into studying gender identity, specifically gender nonconformity and trans identities. And at the same time, I was also coming into my own queer identity and trying to figure that out and developing so many insights along the way. So I think that mix really solidified my passion for working with the LGBTQ plus community. And that is my primary focus in my private practice.
That's great. Can you, Grace, for our listeners and just in general, can you kind of clarify some of the terminology? I know there's a lot of different names. There's a lot of different terms. Yeah. And one, we want to make sure that we're using the most appropriate and respectful terms. I know, like, especially even with LGBTQ plus, I've heard LGBTQIA plus, I've heard a whole bunch of different, you know, letters associated with. And can you just kind of explain some of that and clarify some of that information for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is really important to clarify. And also with the understanding that a lot of these identities can mean very different things for different people. So I'll kind of run through some of the letters and the most commonly used acronyms.
Great,
so
great.
LGBTQ plus. So L stands for lesbian, G gay, B bisexual, T transgender, and Q queer. So
Okay.
Yeah.
I always thought it was questioning. So thank you for clarifying that. Okay.
Well, it can also be questioning.
Okay.
Yep. It can be queer questioning. And then the plus is basically acknowledging that there are a lot of other different gender and sexual identities that can't be incorporated just into those letters. So you'll see I, which is intersex, and A, which is asexual. And then there's a whole host of different other identity labels that people assume that aren't necessarily represented there. So that's what the plus is generally about.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, good. And then the other thing that I think has come up at least more frequently is asking about pronouns. So for example, should people be asking for them? Why or why not? And why would that even be important? You know, just on normal, let's say, outside of therapy terms. And then why would it be more important in therapy terms as well? Maybe it's the same answer.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I think it's probably the same answer. But I think, yes, always ask for pronouns for people, even if you assume, even if you're making an assumption around what pronouns they use. Because a big part of this is understanding that you can't assume someone's gender or sexual identity just by the way that they are presenting to you, just by the way that they look or speak or interact with you. So asking someone's pronouns is really important to affirm their gender identity. And because there's a lot of fluidity in that, some people use sort of what I would call one set of pronouns, which for me is like she and her, but some people also use multiple pronouns, right? So she, they, him, there's a whole host of other ones we can choose from, but people who use multiple pronouns also might have those pronouns. They might prefer to use different pronouns on different days. And so really just kind of approaching this sense of fluidity and things not necessarily being static and being always sort of like put into a very specific rule or category, which is what a lot of us feel comfortable with, is sort of a safe way to orient yourself around this. It's just kind of, you know, challenge your assumptions around it, ask someone very sort of directly and with some care and compassion. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a long conversation, but it can really go a long way in helping them feel affirmed and seen and valued.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit and help clarify a little bit? I know you had spoken earlier about working in a lot of gender-based programs and then, mm-hmm. you know, seeing that there's this whole population that was not really being represented in those and that there's all different types of gender identities and non-conforming and non-binary. Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about those different aspects, transgender, mm-hmm. cisgender, non-binary, yeah. what that means?
Definitely, yeah. So cisgender is a term used to describe people whose gender identity, so their personal sense of gender, aligns with the sex that they were assigned at birth, typically by a doctor, based on their, you know, sort of like genitals and other biological mm-hmm. characteristics. So that's what cisgender means. So in my example, a doctor assigned me a female, a girl at birth, and I identify as a woman. So I am cisgender.
Okay.
But okay. transgender is basically an umbrella term for someone who has a gender identity that is different than the sex that they were assigned at birth. So the way that we understand that is, you know, typically, I should just speak for me, you know, I was raised in this world where you were presented with a binary. So two different types of sex or gender. So you could be male or you could be female. And so basically, you know, what we are, you know, trying to support people with is understanding that that binary is actually not reflective of how people identify in their gender. And there's a whole spectrum, you know, with male and female on either side or somewhere on that spectrum, but there's a lot of other identities in between. And so that's where you see identities like non-binary, which basically just means mm-hmm. I don't fit into one of those two categories. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of other ones that, you know, basically you can say, if I am trans, I am basically not identifying with the sex I was assigned at birth. And there's a whole host of different identities within that could more specifically categorize how someone identifies.
I think that's really, totally makes sense. And Actually it was funny because I was in the car with Matej's daughter and her friends, and they had gone to visit a high school, and they were talking about the person that was their shadow person, like they had to follow around that day, was a mm-hmm. trans female student, a trans mm-hmm. girl. And they were like trying to figure out, what did that mean? And so then mm-hmm. the way I assumed, and please correct me if I'm wrong, was that person was their assigned sex at birth by the doctor was male, but they were trans female. Is that wrong, or did I mess that up?
I mean, I think from the very limited information we have about this person, that sounds about right. But let's also recognize that being a trans woman can mm-hmm. also mean that you are not necessarily feminine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you can be a woman of any kind, a trans woman, a cis woman, and not necessarily be presenting in a very feminine mm-hmm. way. So there's also, there's a whole wonderful complex world of different ways people can step into their gender, which is what I love most about some of the work I do. But for a very sort of simplistic understanding, so that person, if they're identifying as trans, means, you know, if they were assigned male at birth, for example, they don't identify with that as their gender. And if they mm-hmm. are a trans woman, then they identify as a woman.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It was one of those things where I was trying to like step through this gently and trying to figure out what they, because I was also not supposed to be part of the conversation because I was a driver only. So I was just I'm trying to clarify, like, you know, let's be sensitive. What are we talking about here? So I guess the next thing would be is, why would it be important to be, let's say, a gender affirming counselor? What does that mean, gender affirming counselor? Because I know it's in a term that I've seen on other people's websites that have worked with the LGBTQI+ community. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, that's such a great question and so important in the work that we do, because we are supporting people in one of the most intimate ways you possibly can. And mm-hmm. by being gender affirming basically means I am not going to try to force any labels on you around your gender or I'm not going to put a value on you that you need to subscribe to this gender binary that we are all fed growing up. And I will support you and affirm you in whatever gender identity and expression that feels right for you. And that to me feels like such a crucial element of providing a safe space for someone to really do some intimate deep work around seeing them for who they really are, mm-hmm. and really helping them step into that. If we are providing resistance to that or some judgment around that in the therapy space, unfortunately, we are one of many other people in that person's lives that is doing that to them. And to me, that's not healing and that's not therapeutic.
Absolutely. And so, and that's, I mean, you're right. That's your goal as a therapist, is to be therapeutic and help the person heal. And if you're just kind of adding to that, that's definitely not a safe space for them.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I think too, just recognizing that their gender identity is going to really influence all the other topics that come up in therapy, right? The way someone experiences conflict in relationships or, treatment at work, that's all going to be influenced by their gender identity. So it's really important to meet them where they're at.
Absolutely. Can you talk to us about some of the common themes and topics that clients may come to see you about that is specific to the LGBTQ plus community?
Yeah, definitely. Well, many people who come to see me are in an exploratory phase around their gender or sexual identity and are feeling a sense of curiosity around how they want to experience these things and what words to use to describe that for themselves and others. And one thing I find really interesting is that for most of my clients, they've had some inkling about this for quite a long time that they've either ignored or suppressed or reasoned away somehow, you know, maybe only getting in touch with it in private or in spaces like online that are very confidential, but have never really fully opened up to this part of themselves until now. And so this could be someone exploring a different gender expression in private by wearing, you know, by wearing different types of clothes that they might not normally wear out in public because of how they might be perceived in their gender. This could look like someone, you know, sort of like stepping into an online space for queer people and, you know, engaging with people there, but feeling like this is not something that they have fully been able to embrace for themselves. And so a lot of our work is really saying, you know, as much as you've tried to contain this and engage with it in private or even hide it from other people, this part of you is not going away. So how can we learn that what it has to say is important, and how do we listen to it, and how do we welcome it, how do we love it, and how do we help it grow and nurture it and do that in a way that feels right? So, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, you know, to kind of do a follow-up question, then could you speak to then, because this is exactly what people are coming to therapy, period, right, is to be heard and to be accepted and to figure out how this therapy could, this therapeutic relationship could be modeled then in the real world, right, so that people could be affirmed and accepted. What happens then with something like, for example, the controversial conversion therapy?
Right. So
can you speak to that for a second?
That's basically the opposite of gender affirming therapy or queer affirming therapy.
Yeah. So I think it's important for people to know why that is.
Yes. So conversion therapy, from what I know of it, is basically this approach that's saying being gay or being trans or being something other than straight or cis is a problem and it's a pathology and we need to rid you of that, which is, in my opinion, just not possible and is very hurtful. Mm-hmm. So you try
and draconian. It almost sounds like something from like the 1800s, like a lobotomy type of, in my opinion. I know people have many opinions, but that is my opinion that I think that it sounds so horrific.
Oh, absolutely. And it causes so much harm for people that it basically encourages a lot of shame and guilt. And you know, that's something that without conversion therapy, a lot of queer and trans people are already working through around their identities. So in my, you know, from my understanding of it, like I said, it's just extremely harmful to people and is the complete opposite of how you would want to support someone in therapy.
And I really hope it's gone soon. I don't even know. Totally. I only hear about it randomly, but it's like, I don't even want to say which states of the world, of the United States that I hear it coming from. But that's the only, my only, you know, touch base is that I'm like, where is that even happening?
Yeah, right.
So. Sorry, go ahead, Jen. Sorry. No, I digress sometimes.
I was just going to say, so there are, as we know, there are therapists out there who do conversion therapy and who are not gender affirming therapists and are not, you know, their own personal viewpoints may, you know, kind of cloud their judgment in therapy. So what would be something that somebody who is in the LGBTQ plus community should know about looking for a therapist or finding therapy? Kind of what should they be looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would first encourage anyone from the LGBTQ plus community to trust that there are plenty of competent and caring therapists out there who can support them in the way they need. You know, sometimes it can feel like if you have some type of marginalized identity that there's a scarcity mindset around what's possible for you, which, you know, obviously is real in some scenarios, but in searching for a therapist, I really hope people understand that there are so many people out there to choose from that could be supportive. So I would also encourage them. So I would encourage them to put a lot of time and effort into finding a therapist that feels right, setting up consultation calls, getting a feel from the therapist's website to, you know, get a sense of their approach and their values. And I would also encourage them to realize and think about, I mean, this goes for anyone, that therapy can be hard enough sometimes. So are there things that can make this process feel a little bit safer or a little bit easier for you? Right. So in a lot of places, even in big cities, the queer community can be very small or can feel very small and interconnected. So is there a way that you can feel more trustworthy in this process? Is there a way that you can be, you know, have conversations with people around what it might be like to maintain confidentiality and not have, you know, some intersecting friends in the circle. So I would say thinking about that. I would also really encourage anyone from the LGBTQ plus community to really think about, you know, the importance of working with a therapist who has lived experience in that community.
Why do you think that is? Why would you find that to be important?
Well, I think that, again, therapy is tough, right? And I think that there's a lot of specific challenges that people from this community have to go through that are very hard to understand if you have not lived that yourself. So obviously, as I said before, anyone in this sort of community is not, like, this is not a monolith. So not everyone is going to have the same experience. Even if you identify as a gay man and you're looking for a gay male therapist, their experience is still going to be very different from your own. But, or I should say, and having a therapist who has a basic foundational understanding of the culture and of what that process feels like of stepping away from cis normativity and heteronormativity and finding an identity that feels right can be so foundational to building trust in that space. And it just, you know, it helps people, you know, feel like they don't need to step into the role of an educator either in trying to explain that to somebody who doesn't understand.
I think that's so important. Yeah. I think that for a lot of different issues, you know, like you said before, it's so hard to get into therapy. It's so hard for someone to understand and then go through all those barriers of like, okay, let me explain how it is for me. You know, that's hard enough without having maybe this common thread and maybe understanding like this is where we come from. This is where, you know, even for a therapist to reflect on their own experiences, it could be really transformational. Is there anything else? I know that we have two big topics to talk about with you today, but before we leave this big topic of LGBTQI plus communities, is there anything else that you'd want people to know about the community, therapy, or just what are some important things that you'd want, you know, just our listeners to hear about that maybe they just don't know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing that I think is important to know about working with the LGBTQ plus community is that, yes, there are a lot of challenges to work through, and there can be a lot of conflict in someone's internal sense of self and in their outer world with people that needs a lot of time and care and attention. But a lot of this work is also realizing that this struggle does not have to be an inherent part of these identities. It can be in a lot of ways because of, unfortunately, the society we live in that's not always very affirming mm-hmm. and supportive. But it's also about, as I'm moving through these struggles, as I'm working through these conflicts, how do I also identify what I need and want, center that, and go after that so I can experience pleasure and joy and humor and lightheartedness and ease and be able to have those things woven into my life that really feels like this is where I want to pull my identity from. You know, I don't want to be, you know, identifying with all of this struggle, but really understanding that a lot of this is making space for it all without feeling like, you know, the only thing we have of substance in therapy is conflict, which is just not the case. There's so much more. There's so much more that we do.
I like that. Thank you.
Yeah.
For sharing that, those little tidbits of wisdom to us. Yeah. And now kind of switching gears a little bit, as Jessica said, kind of you have two main focuses with your work. Can you tell us a little bit about your work with ACT and exposure therapy? Kind of what are those types of treatment modalities, and a little bit more about that?
Yeah, definitely. So ACT stands for Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, which is very rooted in a sense of, as one would guess, acceptance around certain experiences and, again, commitment to doing things that are valuable to you. So it kind of lays it out for you in the name, but it is a really great approach that is rooted less on, you know, trying to necessarily fix things or control things, but sort of like almost relinquishing control, accepting things, but also taking action on things that feel valuable to you. So I can get into that more if we want, but just kind of switching over to exposure therapy. Exposure therapy is a type of therapeutic intervention where the client is exposed to a variety of feared situations repeatedly over time to increase their tolerance for distress in these situations. And this helps them really accept uncertainty around the fact that, yes, bad things do happen, but there is no way for me to predict those things or when they're going to happen. And I can also still do things that are important to me when I am feeling scared and distressed. So it does, you know, I love merging these two. As you can see, there are some parallels here of kind of stepping into a space that is scary and uncomfortable, tolerating what's happening for you emotionally, but then still staying there or doing the thing you want to do because it's valuable and it brings meaning to your life. And, you know, if you don't, then your world becomes really small because then you just avoid a lot of situations that are scary and don't want to engage at all.
You know, and it's interesting that, you know, you merge those two together because it does make a lot of sense that would make, you know, that would be the best way to, you know, do therapy would be to have those two different modalities. My question is, because Jen knows a lot about ACT, okay? So
yeah,
I know very little about ACT, okay? And I still say ACT, like what
are we talking about? No,
So that's because I'm just clueless. But as an example, and this is, I guess, to both of you, what would be an example of ACT in action? Let's say I'm coming in to you, I am client, you know, Jessica, you know, with my anxiety about Sunday scaries. Okay. Cause we're recording on a Sunday right now. So what would an example of using ACT? I know that sounds so broad, but like, you know, what would be an example of using that, you know, ACT in therapy? How would that look as a treatment modality?
Yeah. I love that you brought up Sunday scaries. Cause that is such a common experience for people. So very relatable. But I think that, so I think, you know, on a very broad scope, what I would say is, you know, I work with this client and saying, what's happening for you on Sunday? Mm-hmm. What are you feeling? What's your emotional state? What is your body doing? And what are you doing to try to get rid of that? And so people might say, well, I am, you know, I'm like cleaning the house like mad, or I am, you know, going out to the bar and just trying to forget about things, or I am, you know, really just sort of like thinking and ruminating and, you know, really just feeling distressed about what I have to do at work this week and how it's going to be impossible. And so what I would encourage that person to do is really just see that, is there a way to pull back on the struggle that you're feeling around the anxiety? And is there a way to slow yourself down so that you can tolerate whatever your body is doing in that moment and get to a place of, you know, relative stability, where you can sort of ask yourself, what feels most important to me on this Sunday? Mm-hmm. Is it preparing for work and showing up in a way that makes me feel confident? Is it spending time with my family and friends? Is it cooking myself a nice meal? And so how can I still commit to doing those value-based behaviors when I am feeling this distress about the work week ahead without fighting against it? So it's really just saying, I'm going to feel this way internally, and I'm willing to tolerate that while I do activities that are important to me on a very basic level.
I like that. I think that makes a lot of sense, because it's almost like the opposite of, like, when people come in to see me and say, I just want to just stop thinking about this. I'm like, well, that's
exactly
not gonna happen.
Right.
Like, FYI, like, I hate to burst everyone's bubble. It's not going to, thought stopping does not work ever.
Totally. So. Yes. And I do a lot of, when I was working with patients in the hospital, we do a lot of identifying what your values are and the behaviors that you're engaging in, and the thoughts that you're getting stuck in, are those moving you towards your values, or are they moving you away from your values? And what can we do then to continue to move towards your values? Because that's like something that you look forward to. Those are things that make you feel good. They're things that are important to you. And so how can we focus on those things versus things that we most of the time cannot change? Like, we don't have control over some of the things that were making us anxious and worried.
Yes, absolutely. And I love that idea too in ACT, because there's kind of this whole premise that control is the problem, not the solution. And sometimes when I say that to people, they're like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, that causes anxiety already. You know, just kind of like thinking about that, because we all want to feel like we're in control, but, you know, the more control we try to exert over things that are uncontrollable, we're just wasting a lot of energy. And like you said, Jen, we're moving away from those things that are really important to us.
The next question I would ask is, you know, because part of exposure therapy, as you had said, was to expose somebody, you know, repeatedly over the things that basically they're fearful over. How does anxiety then, in your opinion, work in our bodies and our brains? What does that look like to people that may not even realize, you know, some of the listeners don't even realize they have anxiety? What would that look like?
Yeah, definitely. Well, the tricky thing is that it can show up in a lot of different ways, but some of the very common, you know, kind of ways I see it show up for people is in your body, it can feel like a sense of nervousness or tension or heightened sense of urgency. You know, this might feel like a rapid heart rate or shallow breathing, sort of this feeling of having excess energy without clarity around what to do with it necessarily. So that's what I see in sort of like people who have anxiety that turns their volume up, right? There's like a lot of energy and urgency and speed, but there can also be an experience of your body, what I would say, turning the volume down, which is almost exhausting your body to the point where it's really fatigued, or it just wants to sort of, you know, detach and step away from people, or feels like just totally paralyzed around what to do in a given situation. So those are some common bodily responses. And then in terms of our brains, it shows up a lot as just excessive worry and rumination, thinking about all the worst case scenarios and the what ifs, what if this happens, what if that happens. And through that, it can feel like you're mentally trying to solve all of these problems that can't necessarily be solved. So like there's a feeling of impending doom, or something bad is going to happen and I need to figure out how to present it. So going back to that idea of control, right? Like anxiety is mainly focused on how do I control these things that, you know, either are I think are going to happen in the future or who have already happened in the past, which, as you know, we can probably all realize that there's some things you can do to sort of like remedy what happened in the past or prepare for things in the future, but you can't control all of it. So right. Eventually that anxiety just feels like it's, you know, it's exerting or it's spending a lot of energy that's not necessarily giving you what you're looking for.
Absolutely. So what we've talked about anxiety before on the podcast. Yeah. I don't think you can ever anxiety.
Yeah.
Something that I think everybody experiences anxiety in some form or another. So when is anxiety normal and when is it not? How do we know the difference? How do we know that this is not anxious every time I have to present?
Mm-hmm.
But is this normal anxiety? Is it not normal anxiety?
Yeah, always good to clarify that. And that's actually a lot of my work is helping people distinguish how much of this is helpful and how much of it isn't. So anxiety in general is a very common, normal human emotion that can be helpful and formative, or it can be, as you mentioned, just really, you know, hurtful and dysfunctional for what you need to do. So anxiety can be really helpful when it signals to you that there actually is some kind of danger. So this could be real physical danger in terms of like, there's a storm coming and I might get hurt in this and I need to do something about it. Or it can be emotional danger. Like I'm preparing for, like you said, a presentation or an interview, and I might go through this and be emotionally hurt by this. So in both of those cases, there's actually a level of control you have in how you prepare for them. Right. So like I can prepare for a storm and get ready to reduce the risk. I can prepare for an interview or a presentation and review my notes and rehearse with a friend. But there's always going to be something about those things that you just can't control and you can't predict. So, for example, if you spend all this time trying to anticipate every single question the interviewer is going to give you and what your response would be, you're going to spend a lot of energy preparing for things that never happen. Mm-hmm. And that might make you feel nervous, and that might take up a lot of time. And that might also, you know, distract you from, as we were just talking about, those really values-based behaviors that are fulfilling for you. So to me, there's like, you know, there's some line somewhere, and it takes a lot of work to find out where it is, but there is a line of when anxiety feels normal and helpful and when it feels harmful.
And then I guess the next, you know, line outside of anxiety, if this is like a little tree, was what is OCD then? Because I think a lot of people use the term obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, constantly. Like, you know, if I see somebody with a very neat pantry, let's say, for example, on Instagram, they're like, I have OCD. And I'm like, but do you really, you know, like, do you understand? So okay, it's just to clarify, you know, of us using it just, you know, so like flippantly, what does that mean?
Right. So glad you brought that up, because it is so much more than being neat and tidy.
Exactly.
And it is related to anxiety. You know, it used to be, so OCD is obsessive compulsive disorder, and it used to be listed under the category of anxiety disorders in the old DSM, so the Manual of Psychological Disorders, but it's since been separated out because there are some key differences. So OCD is a mental health condition that causes someone to fixate on intrusive inner experiences. So these are the obsessions. So these are like thoughts or images or bodily sensations that represent some feared consequence for them, which then creates an urgency for that person to engage with compulsions. So those compulsions are usually repetitive behaviors or thoughts that are used to ease the anxiety around the obsessions or sort of avoid that feared consequence somehow. So I'll give you an example. I think that always helps.
Yep.
So I work with, and just to also highlight that all the ways that OCD can show up. So I work with a lot of people who have obsessive thoughts about wanting to harm someone they love. This is a really, as you can imagine, really difficult inner experience for someone to have. So they could be having all of these sort of obsessive thoughts that what if I did harm someone I love in the middle of the night? What if I am going to harm someone I love? You know, it, did this happen or is this going to happen? And this obsession could be really triggered by certain objects. So it could be triggered by seeing knives in their home, and their compulsions then could be, okay, I'm going to check to make sure the knives haven't moved from their position, that I haven't been in the kitchen. I'm going to mentally review, you know, all of the steps I took and all the places I was and what I was doing to make sure that I didn't touch that and I didn't harm someone. And then they can also, you know, you can also like ask the person they're concerned about if they're okay and to make sure they're not harmed and to be calling them a lot and sort of checking for reassurance there. So this is obviously a very different experience to some of the more like general anxiety that people feel is like, even though someone from the outside might look at this obsession and say, what are you talking about? You're not going to harm someone. And even if the person with OCD can say, well, yeah, I don't think I'm going to, OCD really wants 100% certainty. And so like logic and reasoning and like thinking about probability doesn't usually work with OCD because your body is just convinced that it's real.
I really think that's important to clarify because again, it's beyond just my pantry is neat, obviously.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like that example that you gave because I think so many times people who are not in the field and don't have experience working with OCD, a lot of times do think about it's the person who's like excessively washing their hands or excessively cleaning things or excessively like checking that they unplugged their like curling iron or that they locked their doors, but that there's really this kind of other side of it that people you don't see. You don't see what's happening internally for somebody who's struggling with OCD, and it's great to kind of shed the light on that.
Yeah, and that's sometimes, you know, called, it's a misnomer, but it's called pure O, like pure obsessions, but it's not, you know, that's not actually accurate because there are compulsions, but there's basically this, you know, type of OCD that is just purely mental or like purely emotional and mental. It's all an internal experience. So that can be a really hard thing because no one can really see the behaviors that are happening. You can't see the compulsions, but it might just be happening in someone's mind. And so it can be just like such an isolating experience for people unless they have a space to talk through it and connect with people about it.
Absolutely. And sometimes they're like, so they don't.
Yeah.
Like, they don't want to share that with somebody because other people. Like you're crazy for having a thought like that, or like they're just sometimes you just don't understand.
Yes, absolutely. And so that's, you know, that can create a lot of shame and guilt that shows up in people who have OCD, which again kind of like ties into the thread of the other population I work with, which is the queer community, which also, you know, we have to tackle a lot of shame and guilt around their potential identities. So a lot of this is really helping people understand themselves a little bit better and realize that they're not the only person going through this, which is a really common experience that I've seen with OCD is someone feeling like, well, this is different. Like my experience is different and this is real. And I know everyone else is fine, but like, this is going to be real for me, which kind of signals just how deep, like deeply held these feared situations are for people with OCD. It's very hard to break through sometimes.
Absolutely. Can you, Grace, talk with us a little bit about exposure therapy and why exposure therapy would be helpful in somebody's therapy journey?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, it's basically exposing people to a feared situation repeatedly over time. And through that experience, you're helping someone really navigate, how do I interact with this situation and not either A, do my compulsion, or B, you know, get the heck out of there and leave as soon as possible. So I will say with exposure therapy, there's been a shift in sort of what the goal of the therapy is. So originally, it was based on this idea of habituation, which is basically if I enter that feared situation repeatedly over time, I'm going to essentially acclimate to that to the point where my anxiety drops. So then the goal becomes, okay, my anxiety is going to drop the more I interact with this. So it's kind of like, I'm going to watch a scary movie 10 times. And by that 10th time, I want to be less scared, less anxious about it. And that's my goal, which works sometimes. But again, kind of thinking about that acceptance and commitment therapy approach, we can't always make the goal to reduce our anxiety or to control that anxiety. So instead, there's this shift of, you know, thinking about what's called the inhibitory learning model. So that's basically coming from the perspective that we're going to engage with these feared situations, and we're going to continually, through that, teach your brain over time that you can be in that situation and you can experience relative safety, meaning for the most part, when you engage in that situation, your feared consequence doesn't matter, doesn't happen. So in the example I had before, I can have someone go to their kitchen and hold a knife, and they can feel a lot of distress around that. And they can learn to sit with that distress and tolerate it. But they see that actually every time I touch a knife, I don't harm someone I love. And so it sort of becomes like teaching your brain something different through that experience of being in that. So it can be really helpful for, again, you know, really just helping people realize that there's more they can handle. And exposure therapy can also be really great for anxiety too, specifically like social anxiety. You know, I have a lot of people who, you know, will do exposures around just like going out on the street and chatting up, you know, someone who they don't know and trying to start a conversation with them, which in New York City is very interesting because you never know what you're going to get here. But that's kind of the reality of life, right? I mean, in any city, in any situation, you never know what you're going to get. You never know like how to predict it. And, you know, that's kind of the joy of exposure, is just showing people like the narrative you have around what this is going to be like is going to be different than the reality of it. So let's just go out there and try it and see what happens.
I love that, because I feel like you're absolutely right. And it doesn't matter where you are in the world. You cannot control and expect and know and anticipate every single little thing happening to you. Yeah. And it's going to be exactly that way, right? But we can at least have a skill set that we can use when we go out in this unpredictable world, right? That we can actually, you know, count on that. Okay, this doesn't work. I'm going to try this one. I'm going to try, you know what I mean? I'm going to be able to control, in a sense, control myself, even in this unpredictable world.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the key there too, is like, there are things you can control, which is probably not your anxiety all the time, but you can control how long you stay in that situation, right? You can control if you say yes to going to that party or networking event that you're nervous about. But, you know, so it's really thinking about, where is my control and how do I want to tap into that in a way that feels oriented around my values too?
I really like that. I really do. When people come to see you in therapy, what should they expect or not expect in therapy? Like, what would that look like to someone? Because I think that during COVID, especially or wherever we are in COVID, I can't even say we're post, but whatever it is that we are right now, you know, we've gotten, Jen and I, the reason why we started this podcast, we keep saying it over and over again, is because we had so many people coming to us, either never having been in therapy or wanting to restart it, or didn't know what was happening and wanting to reach out. So what are some of those expectations that you'd want to help people kind of navigate as first timers?
Absolutely. And I will say that's been one of the great things I've seen through this long unending period of COVID, is like so many people are reaching out for the first time and stepping into therapy. So I think it's great to be thinking about this. I can only speak for me, but in what people can expect with me is that, you know, I will be here to support you with a lot of insight and care and sometimes humor and curiosity and a lot of different structures and systems we can work with to help you move through whatever distress you're experiencing. And I will be here to coach you through it, and we will work through it together in a really collaborative way. But what I would tell people not to expect is, you know, for me or another therapist to come in and have some miracle cure to like fix something about them. Because, you know, in my perspective, there's nothing about the person that needs to be necessarily fixed. We just have to find a better way. We just have to change what you're doing a little bit, use the resources you already have, and add a few more in, and then, you know, see what happens, essentially. So I would say, you know, not expecting someone to come in with some like quick fix, or even I would say, like, don't expect to have someone who can come in with a completely objective point of view, because we're humans too, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to distinguish, like, a therapist can be a neutral party in the sense that they're not tied to your social circle, so they don't have a lot of preconceived notions and judgments about your situation, but they do, they aren't objective, they are subjective. And we are all, like, all therapists are coming in with their own value set and their own identities that inform those values and those understandings. So I would say keeping that in mind too, is that this is a relationship with two humans and we're working through together, and the client's gonna put in a lot of work to make the change, and the therapist is gonna be there to guide them and support them along the way. And then another important thing too, as we're talking about exposure therapy, is not to expect therapy being a place where you always feel calm and good and happy.
Mm-hmm.
And why that's important is, as you can imagine, a lot of my work is around, you are going to feel distressed, and you are going to feel anxious, and you are going to feel sad, and you are going to feel joyful and pleasurable and wonderful, and we're going to be here for all of it. But a lot of this is having a safe space to work through more of those difficult emotions. So sometimes therapy is that space where you can really kind of really get in touch with that struggle, but do so in a way where you have active support right with you, and you have someone to sort of debrief that situation with you, and you have skills you can take with you out into the real world. So that's a really key difference, I think, in doing the kind of work I do, is that our goal is not to make you happy and to make you feel good all the time.
I like that. Because I think that, I mean, I think that can be a very scary part of therapy, is that it's not always going to be easy. It's not always going to be comfortable. But like you said, what better place to feel that discomfort and that distress when you have somebody there who can help support you through that moment?
Yeah, absolutely. And thinking, like, we can have all these different emotional states, but, you know, let's focus more on what's giving you meaning and fulfillment and focus on that, and sort of focus on the richness of life and all of the complexities of it, rather than just one specific emotional state.
Absolutely. Well, this next question is one of my favorite to ask, because one of my favorite things about doing the podcast is that we get to meet so many different experts in the field and hear from them and hear their passion and, like, the joy and the love that they have for what they do. So what is it that you like most about your work?
Yeah, there's so much to pull from, but I would say I just feel so incredibly privileged every day to, you know, be alongside people who are asking really tough questions, who are going through tough things, who are trying to reconcile their sense of self, you know, who are really trying to make sense of everything that's happening. And I love just being a human with them in that space and really getting in touch with all of these inner workings that oftentimes they're not sharing openly with other people. They don't feel like they have the space to do that, or there's a lot of shame around doing that. And so I love being able to look into people's lives in that way and be there with them and support them through it. And I think through that, and a remarkable experience is being able to take that and really build trust with somebody. Because I work with a lot of people who have a trauma background of some kind. I mean, I think most people do, but I work with a lot of people who have some, like, pretty severe trauma that has disrupted their ability to trust others and make connections. And so if we can do some of that in our sessions together, it is such a healing and fulfilling experience for both of us, I think. And, you know, that also helps people really slowly to, you know, kind of open themselves up to new possibilities and center their needs and really prioritize themselves. So just the transformation that I'm able to see with people is so fascinating and really, you know, really fulfills me in a way that's hard to describe.
I like that though. I think that that's a really great, that's a really great answer, because I think that, you know, people don't know what therapists are thinking often, you know, and they're, and I think a lot of people, you know, regardless if you've been in therapy once or like 1,000 times, will say, you know, I'm fearful, I'm going to be judged, you know, and, and to know that, you know, you're coming from a place of wanting to, you know, bear witness of to someone's change, transformational change in their life. And again, going back to what you're saying, you're not changing that person from top to bottom. You know, it's not, it's more like, let's do it different. There's nothing wrong with you, but let's do it in a different way. I think that's a really powerful way to approach clients. You know, I'm hoping all therapists are doing this, you know, but maybe not those conversion ones, but you know, the genuine people that are in it to bear witness to that. I think that's wonderful.
Definitely. Yeah. And you know, it's kind of like just, as you were talking, I was thinking about just having more of that experimental approach with people, right? Imagine like teaching a kid how to swim. I mean, I've never done that before, but I can imagine, right? Like
me either.
you kind of have to, like, you know, I'm sure take some small steps, but you basically help them experiment and try new things and get to a place where they can feel comfortable eventually just jumping in and doing it. And I think that's just such an incredible experience that takes time, but it's totally possible. And it completely changes the way people see what's possible for them.
I like that. And then for our last question that we always ask, and that's the purpose of this whole podcast, is what is something that you would like to demystify for our listeners in any area of therapy of what we discussed today or anything else that we didn't discuss?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that we touched on earlier that I just want to emphasize is I really hope people think through how they find the right fit of therapist, because that is the most important, in my perspective, aspect of therapy that's going to determine your quote unquote success with therapy, whatever that means for you. And so I hear a lot of times with people, especially people who are new to therapy, work up the courage to reach out to a therapist and start working with them. And for one reason or another, it doesn't work out. And they walk away thinking, therapy's not for me. It's just not my space. I don't like it, or it's not working. And especially I'm thinking about some of the people I work with who internalize a lot of things. Sometimes people could walk away thinking, I did something wrong, or there's something so wrong with me where I can't be treated, especially for OCD, which can be really, as we've talked about, misunderstood, even with really well-trained therapists. So I would just encourage people, like, think about how much time you put into, you know, interviewing for a job or dating or finding what schools to go to and doing all that research. And why wouldn't you spend a lot of time trying to find the right person to develop such an intimate relationship with, such a personal relationship with? So I would just encourage people to say, you know, yes, it does take time, but it's worth it. And there's a lot of different directories you can start from. You know, Psychology Today is great. I know that's one that's very accessible for folks, but there's a lot of other ones like ZenCare and Inclusive Therapists and ALMA and Open Path Collective. I could go on and on, but I would really encourage people to just look up a bunch of different, look on different directories, set up those consultation calls, really think about how important it is for you to get the kind of person that you need in this situation, and take time doing that.
I appreciate that I mean, I just think it's so hard to find. It's not hard to find a good therapist. Sometimes it's hard to find a good fit for you, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And the one thing that I do tell a lot of people, because they're like, I don't know anyone in therapy. And I'm like, oh, you would be surprised. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there
is
a reason why we are all busy. So like, even reaching out to like someone that you may trust and ask, do you have the number of a therapist? Or maybe your therapist could refer someone to me, if you know what I mean? And so I end up, because of my work, I end up giving referrals to a lot of people that I know based on, like, you know, I'm like, oh, I think this will be a good fit. You know, just, I can just tell, you know, to a girlfriend or to, you know, a parent that I know or whatever. I think that's another way to kind of word of mouth find people that might be good fits, Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, tapping into your own network is great.
Yes, and that just because, you know, if you have a consultation call with a therapist, or even if you meet with a therapist for, you know, a couple sessions and it's not a good fit, doesn't mean that every therapist is going to be like that. Right. And that not to, you know, really not to give up after trying the first one, because it, you know, it does take a while to kind of find a good fit. It would be nice if when you kind of went to go look for a therapist, you got to like see everything about them in a little snippet before,
yeah,
you know, before you actually meet them, but it doesn't work like that. And so sometimes you do have to try a couple times before you find somebody who's a good fit. And even, you know, I've heard people who will say, I saw a therapist who was great at this time in my life, and now that mm-hmm. I'm at a different yes. stage in my life, I need a different type of therapist. I need yes. to try somebody. That's not a good fit at this moment for me.
Absolutely. I've worked with so many clients who we've gone to that point together, and we have to have a conversation around like, it's been so great working together. We've accomplished so much. You've had so much progress, and you just are in a different stage in life and are starting to deal with things that I'm not necessarily trained in or specialized mm-hmm. in. And, you know, I'm not the right person for you right now. And that's okay. You know, a lot of it is, you know, taking that kind of relational approach to therapy where we can practice having some of those conversations around, you know, this isn't working anymore, so I need something different, or how do we end this relationship? And practicing how to have those conversations is going to help you in every other relationship in your life, because there's always going to be endings. There's always going yeah. to be transitions. So, you know, it's a great time to just practice that and work through that together.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. Making time to make a good goodbye happen is a very, you know, yeah. like it's a good life skill. Well, you yes. know, you've taken up a lot of your time.
Yes.
Grace, thank you so much for coming to the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you. So for more yes. information on Grace Dickman and her work, you can find her at realtherapy.co, that's C-O, or on Instagram at realtherapy.co, or at her email at grace@realtherapy.co. thank you for listening. And as always, subscribe to the Everything You Want to Know About Therapy, But We're Too Afraid to Ask podcast. Everywhere you listen to good podcasts, and give us your 5-star review, and follow us on Instagram at therapy_podcast for updates, additional information, and message us with topics and questions you always want to know about, but we're too afraid to ask. We will be posting information that Grace has given to us so generously about a lot of the topics that we talked about. So please be on the lookout for that. And thank you.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you listen to good podcasts. And keep up with episode updates on Instagram at therapy_podcast_. There, you can send us messages on topics you'd like to hear about or anything that comes to mind. Bye for now.